It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. Multiple sclerosis is a neurological condition affecting nearly a million people in the U.S. There's no cure for MS. Treatments focus on slowing the progression of the disease. For one Wisconsin neurologist, the therapy plan for all of his patients includes making art or rekindling artistic passions that were part of their lives before that MS diagnosis. Scientists have long known that the creative arts have therapeutic value. According to a study published last year in the journal Frontiers in Behavioral Neuroscience, things like dance, painting, and music appear to be effective in enhancing mental and physical health. Dr. Ahmed Obidat sees patients who are managing multiple sclerosis and immune disorders of the central nervous system. He's an associate professor of neurology at Froedtert and the Medical College of Wisconsin. Dr. Obidat spoke recently with Kate Archer Kent.
We know that early diagnosis and early treatment is really effective in managing an MS diagnosis. Can you talk about, first, some of the common symptoms of multiple sclerosis?
Certainly. So multiple sclerosis is a relatively common disease that affects mostly younger population. And it is a disease that can present in any way, actually, that has to do with the central nervous system. So when we think about what symptoms can happen in multiple sclerosis, these symptoms can include difficulties with vision, where some people may develop blurred vision or double vision. Some people will have weakness, maybe of an arm or a leg, or sometimes with an arm and a leg, and sometimes with a face too. So the symptoms can be anything, but there are some other symptoms that we often forget about in multiple sclerosis, and we often don't talk much about, that include some of these cognitive difficulties. So people can have memory difficulties, attention difficulties, sometimes can have extreme fatigue that can interfere with day-to-day activity. Other symptoms may also include pain, and pain can be anywhere, and it can be severe and debilitating for people that they can sometimes unable to do their day-to-day activity, or some people would lose their job because of these symptoms. So wide variety, and not every patient similar to the other. So it's a very, it's a disease of very unique characteristic. I often call it like snowflakes, right? Every snowflake is different. Mm-hmm. And this is what I think about multiple sclerosis, is everyone is unique with what they would experience with this disease.
In the midst of that uniqueness, though, you have to tell your patients that there isn't a cure right now for MS. How might that knowledge affect their mental health, their mental well-being?
Correct. Yeah, this is a very important point that you're raising here, is it remains a disease that we can treat, but we cannot cure. But we want to try to live well with MS. And we, as the healthcare team, we want to provide people living with this disease the best we can from any treatment that we can provide or any support that we can provide to help people live their life to the best possible.
And one of those interventions that you use in your practice is the creative arts, that art has a therapeutic value. Can you talk about that and how you are incorporating art into treatment plans?
Yes, this is a great, you know, great question. And really, it is one of the things that's really dear to my heart. Because when you think about us as humans, we are creative. We are born creative. We are able to do a lot of things that we can produce. And sometimes we forget about it because we get busy in life, busy with doing a lot of things. And what we try to do in our practice is we try to talk to people living with multiple sclerosis and other neurological diseases. And we say, let's focus on abilities. Let's focus on how can we create art and how can we incorporate this into day-to-day living. So I always would ask, you know, do you create any art? Have you done any artwork before? And actually, often more than not, people would say, oh, yeah, I used to paint. I used to write poetry. I used to play an instrument and I don't do it anymore. And then we talk about why we're not doing it anymore. They're like, I cannot, because I can't use my fingers to play, for example, the guitar, or I cannot, my vision is not as good as used to be. I cannot paint and perceive colors as I used to. Then we say, well, let's get back to it. Let us help you get back to this. And I want you to try to get out this canvas, get out these colors, get out this guitar that has the dust on it, get it out and try to play it. And I want, next time I see you, I want you to tell me about this. And I want you to report back to me, how did you feel when you do it? And more than not, many of the times people come in back and say, well, you know something? I can play the guitar again. I joined a band again. Or I painted this, and I get my chart messages with paintings where people create and showing me the artwork that they created. But not only this, you know, we had people who are known artists, so they actually are artists, they're professional artists, who developed MS, and then MS really took away a lot of the abilities to move from them. So they had really severe symptoms. And what we did to actually return back to their art career is we helped them to be able to utilize art and employ art making as a rehab strategy. Hmm. Creating art will help build new pathways or even improve the connectivity in some areas where there are no damage that happened by the immune system. So there are ways where we could even see changes in brain networks that can help people, gain back some of the abilities that maybe, you know, were trying, MS was trying to take away from them.
We're talking about the intersection between medicine and art with Dr. Ahmed Obidat. He's a neurologist at Friedert and the Medical College of Wisconsin who sees patients who are diagnosed with multiple sclerosis and includes art into a treatment intervention. Dr. Obidat, you know, art and art practice may not be something that everyone has access to. There's art supplies, there's instrument costs, transportation. You know, if you're going to see art, there's the cost of tickets. And then also there's that free time, the need to be able to spend time away from work or other things. How do you work with patients to make sure that they have the resources, that they have the time to participate in art in meaningful ways that could impact their life?
Yeah, this is a great question. Again, it's definitely, you know, art or creating art is something that may come at with a cost, a financial cost, or also time-related cost. And what we try to do is we try to first gauge interest from the patient and say, you know, is this something that you've done before? And if so, you know, do you have the tools to do it? Do you have canvas at home? Do you have colors? Do you have an instrument at home? And often actually the answer is yes, I do. Then we try to say, well, get those things out back again and try to utilize those things that you already have. If not, then we try actually to develop programs where we can have art making, I would say, workshops and classes and things like this, where we try to partner with nonprofit organizations to design certain art programs. As we move forward with things like this, I think we're going to be able to provide more access to people to be able to enjoy their creativity and be able to produce more and help them through the healing process.
As we talk, it is absolutely apparent that you are convinced that art can really help in the healing process for people. You know, how might the scientific community do the research to better measure the impact of art in the treatment process?
Yeah, this is very, very important question. And do we really need clinical trials to prove that art help people with neurological disease or help people in general? Probably not. But do we have to prove it? Maybe yes. Why is that? Because you mentioned earlier that there may be resources needed to support some of these activities. And maybe for organizations or payers to be able to recognize this as part of the healing process, they need data, right? You need data showing that this works. We all know that art makes people happy, art promotes healing, but we need to prove it through the scientific method.
Because bill insurance for it.
Correct, yeah. Exactly. Or get people to pay for it, right?
Right.
So there have been works around this, and they are studies that looked at not only in people living with neurological disorders, but also people who are aging in life and older adults and even in children. But also there is a role for what we call the functional MRI. So functional MRI is a advanced type of imaging that not only look at the structure of the brain, but looks at the function of the brain as someone is engaged in creative activity. And what those studies have shown on various levels, that there is improved connectivity in certain brain areas and certain neuronal pathways and connections. And not only improvement in this connectivity, but maybe even building new connectivity and new connections that we call the term synaptic plasticity or improvement of connection in specific areas. But, you know, I actually did a quick search on clinicaltrial.gov. It's a website where you find what active clinical studies are going on that looking at treatment or healing for diseases. And I searched how many active or recruiting or just recently completed clinical trials for multiple sclerosis in general. Mm-hmm. And they were over 3,500 studies. But guess what? Only five studies out of the over 3,500 studies, only five studies globally that is looking at something related to the art in the healing of people living with multiple sclerosis. So definitely the connection between healing through the arts and multiple sclerosis is an area that is very much understudied and under-recognized, I would say, from a scientific method and from scientific community.
Well, Dr. Obidat, I appreciate this conversation. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Really, I enjoyed the conversation too. Thank you so much.
That's Dr. Ahmed Obidat, an associate professor of neurology at Froedtert and the Medical College of Wisconsin. He talked to Kid Archer Kent about how he incorporates the creative arts with his patients who are managing the symptoms of multiple sclerosis, a disease of the central nervous system. And for disclosure, Froedtert and the Medical College of Wisconsin are business sponsors of WPR.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, a new book charts the rise of solar power and how it's become the fastest growing form of energy in the world.
Solar's not on the margins anymore, just happening in a few innovative countries. It's happening around the world. It's becoming a big part of global electricity supply.
The Wisconsin author of How Solar Energy Became Cheap, that's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In 1957, you could generate a month's worth of electricity for the average American home using solar panels for around $300,000. Today, you can generate that same amount of electricity using solar panels for about $25. That comparison is in a new book that charts the rise of solar energy and how it's become the cheapest, most efficient power source in the history of the world, even in places that aren't particularly sunny. PV panels convert sunlight into electricity. So how did they get so cheap, and what will it mean for the future of our power grid? Greg Nemeth is a professor in the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. He is the author of How Solar Energy Became Cheap, Pathway to a Solar-Centric Economy. Greg, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks, Kate. It's great to be here.
So the first edition of your book comes out in 2019, exploring how solar energy became so affordable. Why did you see a need to update the book?
I wasn't sure there was a need, but as I looked closer, the progress that's happened in solar in the last 6 years has really been dramatic, and it's really changed the way the solar future looks. So we've had adoption of solar is about four times what it was 6 years ago. The costs have dropped by 75%. And we've seen an array of other changes as well. And so it really shifted the focus of the book to not only update the data and get everything up to date, but also to think about the implications, which is now what happens when solar takes over the global energy system, which it looks like it's headed to do.
So 75% price drop. You quote the International Energy Agency referring to solar as now the cheapest way humans have ever made electricity and as the cheapest form of electricity in almost all countries How cheap is cheap?
Well, electricity, the cost of electricity has been falling over the last 100 years, and it's been rare to have a new technology to come on and undercut what fossil fuels have been giving us over the last 100 years. And so now we have it. And so now we have electricity that was, if you had the first solar cells that we put on satellites in 1958, it would have cost you $300,000 a month to power your home with it. Whereas now, if you just think about the solar and cost it, it's something like $30 or $40 a month for the electricity. So it's come down a lot, but it's also cheaper than the alternative. So that's what's really driving solar and makes it exciting to think about what could happen next.
And yet, it still costs roughly $30,000 to install solar panels on a home here in this country. And that may not be affordable to most families. What do you make of that?
Well, the here in this country is a key part of what you just said, because in the U.S., solar costs about three times what it would cost in other developed countries with similar wages like Australia and Germany, where that $30,000 system would cost $10,000. That's still a substantial expense, but that's on the level of a furnace rather than on the level of a car. And so if we could make some of the changes to the U.S. so that we could pay what the rest of the world is paying for solar, I think we'd see a lot more adoption than we already see.
You say set our eyes on Australia, which followed a model in its use of solar. Rather than building large solar farms owned by utilities, it rapidly installed rooftop solar on homes. About 40% of homes there have solar panels. How did they do that?
Yeah, it's an incredible story. And that's a new story that wasn't in the book in 2019 because it hadn't happened yet. And Australia is interesting because it's a big exporter of fossil fuels, of coal to China, of natural gas to the rest of Asia. And despite that, they really made a big push on going with solar for electricity provision. And it's been things like making the installations really simple and streamlined. You can get a solar panel or a solar system installed in your house, and it comes with a guarantee that they'll do it in one day. And that dramatically reduces the cost. And it's also subtle things like how permitting works and delays with getting the solar installed. All of that is much more turnkey in Australia. But it came from some policy decisions at the national level to say, we're really going to do this. This is the direction we want to go. And there was strong social consensus that we want to take advantage of the low cost, the reliability, not having to rely on fossil fuels, and then the air pollution and climate benefits that come with more and more solar. It's a sunny place, but we have sunny places like that in the U.S. as well. And so it really provides a model for what places like the U.S. and others could do. And it's really pushing on residential solar rather than these large utility scale projects, which is more of what we've done in Wisconsin.
I've learned, too, through your book about this history of how so many countries pitched in on the innovation and advancements of solar. Germany did this, and Japan did this, and U.S. and China and Australia. Is that what is unique here about solar's playbook, that its origin story is not just one place in the world?
Yeah, I think it's pretty distinct because people always want to say who did it, and no one country did it. It was really this kind of relay race where, to simplify the story that you were outlining, I say that the U.S. created the technology, Germany built a market, and China made it cheap. And there were some other countries that played a role as well. But each of the countries that was involved, say six key countries, they contributed something distinct, some know-how or some way of developing policy or developing innovations, and each country was able to build on the other. So it really was the product of this global innovation system. And I think that's kind of the magic of what made it really work so well, is that it were contributions from lots of different places. And now we have availability to do solar in lots of different countries and states. And that is what we're doing today.
I want to pick up on that. How widespread is solar becoming around the world? And then where are the gaps?
So now we've got about 7% of global electricity is coming from solar. And then if you put all energy together, like think of energy that goes into fertilizers and into cars, solar is about 3% of that. And depending on your perspective, that seems like a lot to me, having seen solar be not even a percent for a long time. And it's also a number that's doubling about every 3 years. So you start taking that 7% and doubling that every 3 or 4 years, you get to pretty big numbers very quickly. In fact, by the time you get to the mid-2030s, you're at about half of electricity supply. And so that's the big change that's happening. Solar's not on the margins anymore, just happening in a few innovative countries. It's happening around the world. It's becoming a big part of global electricity supply. And it's being deployed in places that we wouldn't think of being on the technology frontier, like Pakistan has been a big adopter of solar in the last couple of years because the electric grid is so unreliable and because they can get cheap panels next door from China. So we're seeing that happen in lots of different places. And it's interesting because those are different types of places. They have different amounts of sunshine, different electricity systems, different levels of income. And each of them are doing it a little bit differently, but some of them are getting up to really high levels. Like Australia, we already talked about. Chile has gone up above 20% of its electricity, and others are marching forward as well. So it is a global phenomenon that's happening, and it's in a much bigger way than I saw 6 years ago when I did the first edition of the book.
Taking this to Wisconsin then, in 2022, solar accounting for about 3% of Wisconsin's power generation, according to the State Public Service Commission's assessment. It accounted for less than a tenth of a percent in 2015. Is that the typical kind of growth that you're seeing out there?
Yeah, that's exponential growth to go from that tiny number in 2015 to what you said in 2022. And now we're at something like 5% of electricity. That's rapid growth. And I think that's also something that I was noticing when I did the first book in 2018, 2019, and there was kind of big projects being proposed in Wisconsin. I remember thinking, really? We're doing big solar in Wisconsin? I've been seeing it happen in the Middle East and the southwest of the U.S., but that was a sign of things to come. And so that's been happening more and more in our state. So now we're up about 5% of electricity. It's a little bit behind the rest of the U.S., which is about 7%, but it's not too far behind. I think the distinct part about solar in Wisconsin, though, is it's really been utility-scale solar that's driven it and not as much residential scale, which in a lot of other places, Australia is a good example, we're seeing a lot more rooftop solar. And so that's probably where the bigger opportunity is for our state.
Why do you think the utility-scale solar is excelling in Wisconsin versus rooftop?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm not completely sure. I would say one reason is that for a while it was really difficult to do what's called third-party financing. So when you buy a phone, you often pay for it over 2 years. You buy a car, you pay for it over 5 years. So there was ways of doing that with solar where you would actually lease the system from a third party, which would lease it for you. And that was kind of tied up in the courts for quite a while. And I think that's put a chill on the residential sector. So getting some of the rules straightened out, getting the permitting very streamlined, and that'll help the installer community get mature and efficient at installing solar. And I think that's a roadway for us to get to more solar on rooftops, because we're a little bit less than 1% of all homes in Wisconsin have solar. And that's behind where the rest of the U.S. is.
We're talking about how solar power became so cheap and efficient. Greg Nemeth is the author of How Solar Energy Became Cheap, Pathway to a Solar-Centric Economy. Greg, as you talk about U.S. inventing solar technology, Germany creating markets for it, and China making it cheap, right now you quote that the world's PV modules have, you know, basically China has become more and more of the producer of these modules. Is that where the market for manufacturing remains? And then thinking about that in the context of a trade war, what's going on?
Yeah, that's a hot issue right now. It has been for a while. I mean, the first tariffs on solar were put in place by the Obama administration in 2010. So it's been a trade war for a while, and it's also become more concentrated in China. And that's actually a surprise to me. But from where I was in 2019 to this new book in 2025, I had this idea that eventually the know-how would get dispersed and places in India or Saudi Arabia or Vietnam, and especially in the U.S., would start to produce their own solar because they can do whatever China had done to put together the machines and optimize the supply chain and produce them. But China's just found a way to keep making solar cheaper and cheaper. And so it's been way more of a moving target than I would have expected. And so for the whole world, in a lot of ways, it's incredible because that you know, a $30,000 system is now $10,000 and will go to $5,000. So that's been beneficial for the rest of the world. There are concerns, though, about having such a core technology being mostly produced in one place. And so a lot of the effort in the last, I would say, 3 or 4 years for the U.S. to develop its own supply chain and produce its own solar has been bearing some fruit and has been growing. And it's not at the scale of China. It's still small. But the fact that we have a potential to grow a industry in the U.S., I think, could be very helpful for countering that. But I also think that production eventually will start to move away from China to other places. And we're already having a lot of solar produced in places like Vietnam and Malaysia, and to some extent in the U.S.
Silicon, the primary input material for these solar modules, can the U.S. get that type of material, efficiently, quickly, and at the right price?
Yeah, material is no problem with solar. We can make it. You know, we're basically using sand to make silicon chips, and quartz, and we're using sand to make glass. And glass is the biggest component of solar. Silicon's kind of the core technology to convert the sunlight to electricity. So, and then there's copper and aluminum and other things. There's nothing exotic in solar. There's nothing toxic, and there's nothing rare. And that's different from wind turbines. It's different from electric vehicles and batteries. So solar really does not have these constraints about materials that others do. And so that's not something we have to worry about in the U.S. It's more just assembling the manufacturing capability to make the raw material, the purified silicon, and then to process it into solar cells and into modules.
We're seeing the Trump administration roll back subsidies for solar energy, for energy programs. And it's interesting because you wrote about how President Reagan made cuts to our country's solar program in 1981. And it made me wonder, do you see parallels now under the Trump administration with cuts to clean energy programs?
Great to have that question, because I just think it's so, to me, important to use our history and experience to inform what we've got today. And so I think there are parallels and there are limitations of that comparison. So first of all, the parallel is what happened after 1981. So we invested hugely in solar in the 1970s. And then after the Reagan election in 1981, we cut the solar R&D budget by 85% within a couple of years. And so that's kind of what's been happening now in terms of cutting the subsidies for solar and the research spending as well. What happened in the 80s is that the frontier of innovation went elsewhere. It went to Japan and eventually Germany and eventually China, because that's where the innovation was, that's where the support was, and eventually that's where the markets were. And so on one hand, that would be my biggest concern right now is for solar, but a lot of other clean energy technologies that are just growing. There's huge demand for them around the world, that gets met by other countries rather than the U.S. And so that's a concern and definitely historical parallels. The difference is that there's a lot more momentum with the industry now than there was in 1981. So it's big, it's mature, it's several percent of global electricity supply. There's big companies involved. And so there isn't the sense that we can just cut off clean energy the way we really did in 1981. So there's momentum behind it. The recent policies are going to slow down the growth in the U.S., but they won't slow down the growth in the rest of the world, and they won't stop growth in the U.S. But it's also a point where we need to be speeding up our deployment of solar and clean energy technologies. And that's where I really do have concerns, because these policies are taking away support and will slow things down.
Another takeaway, you say that we need more than just solar. We need other technologies in the mix, in the energy mix. I mean, what lessons can we take away from the solar industry that could be applied to other green energies or technologies that could play well with solar?
Solar works a lot better when you've got friendly other technologies. We've got wind power that's great, because when it's sunny and it's windy are usually different times, so that can work well together. You can build transmission that links those together. Batteries help a lot, because you can store energy and use it later in the day. So that helps a lot. And then just using information technology and sensors and smart devices can move energy around, or you use energy at different times so that when it's available, you use more of it. So that all helps. And those other technologies also need support. And what we found with solar is that there's some combination of, you want to focus on the improving the technology, so sometimes called technology push. That can be R&D, it can be education, research and science, new materials, getting people smart on what the frontier of innovation is. So that's part of it. The other side of it is markets, and that's where we want to actually have demand for things like solar, like electric vehicles, like wind turbines, like smart devices, and other technologies we might need. And that's the part that's moved away in the last 6 months, and that's what the U.S. was really leading on, was having these kind of small initial markets for solar, for wind, for electric vehicles, and in other things like advanced nuclear reactors and other technologies that could be very useful. And that part I'm concerned about, because that part we're missing in a lot of our clean energy innovation right now, the market side where we actually have customers for these technologies.
I wonder if that is where the pessimism has been lurking about solar's potential, because you talk about how there were a lot of people who are just thumbs down on solar, but that could also be changing.
Yeah, I mean, solar, it's changing in that it's becoming more mainstream. It's not as exotic. It's becoming more affordable, and it's working well because this whole system is getting better designed to use it. And also, we have other models. We can look to places like Australia, like Germany, like Spain, like Chile, that where they're not having problems with keeping the lights on, even though they're using sometimes 50% solar at certain times. So there's a lot of reasons why we should expect solar will continue and will grow. It's just we're taking some of the support away from that movement at a time when we really need to be accelerating it and pushing it and taking advantage of this resource that we now have that we didn't have 10 years ago. So I think that's where we're really squandering an opportunity.
Greg, thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be here. Good talking to you about it.
Greg Nemet is a professor in the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison, author of How Solar Energy Became Cheap, Pathway to a Solar-Centric Economy. His new book is a history of solar energy and an exploration for how it's become inexpensive.
Coming up, if you've ever had trouble pronouncing a place name in Wisconsin, you're not alone. We'll meet the creator of the website Mispronouncer and find out the one mistake she wants everyone to avoid.
Randomly, I'd hear people say Wisconsin, and it would just kind of get my goat.
That's coming up next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer Kent. You may have seen the joke before. You're not a true Wisconsinite unless you know how to pronounce Oconomowoc.
And that's not the only tongue twister here in the state. You've got Wauwatosa, New Berlin, not New Berlin, and don't forget Shawamigan-Nicolet National Forest. The list goes on.
As radio broadcasters, it's kind of our job to know this stuff, and we do need help from time to time. For many years, Harold Ingalls' book, Wisconsin Place Names, A Pronouncing Gazetteer, was a vital resource around here.
But there's nothing quite like hearing the correct pronunciation to really get it in your head. That's where former broadcaster Jackie Johnson came in. Back in 2005, she started a new website to help people say Wisconsin place names like a local. It's called mispronouncer.com. This year, the website is celebrating 20 years online. Plus, the state cartographer's office just released a new interactive map called Pronounce Wisconsin that uses Jackie's audio clips. Jackie Johnson is a former reporter anchor for Wisconsin Radio Network. She's the creator behind the website mispronouncer.com. And Joe Sammons is a professor of linguistics at UW-Madison and co-founder of the Center for the Study of Upper Midwestern Cultures. He co-edited the book Wisconsin Talk, Linguistic Diversity in the Badger State. Joe, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
And Jackie, thanks for being with us.
Oh, I'm glad to be here.
All right, Jackie, I was an early adopter of your website, Mispronouncer. I started here in 99. We had a book that we used for a lot of place name pronouncers. You came along in, I think, 2005 with Mispronouncer, and we loved it here. What led you to make these recordings of yourself saying Wisconsin place names and share them online with the world?
Oh, gee, I was really dedicated at that time. I don't know what came over me. It was a lot of work. But I was in broadcast radio doing the morning shift, and I was reading some AP, some wire copy, And sometimes a name of a city came across that I didn't recognize, and there was nobody around. You know, sometimes when you do the morning shift, there's no one else in the building. You know, you're the first one there sometimes. And so after a while, I thought, man, this can't keep happening regularly. I need to figure this out. I need to get some sort of guide. And I wasn't aware of that book that has some pronunciations in there. So I just compiled a list. I went through all the work and effort of calling people if I didn't know and put it all together.
And Jackie, we both work in radio or have worked in radio. This is an occupational hazard. And I know one time we had a new announcer give Waukesha instead of Waukesha. You hear about that, right? When you say somebody's town name wrong, they take umbrage.
Well, yes. And you know what? Sometimes when I watch local TV news or radio, and this is not a criticism of anybody per se, but if I hear a new broadcaster and they do say something like that, I kind of cringe and I think, well, it's not as though there's not a reference out there for them.
Now, Joe, you've done a lot of linguistic research looking at Wisconsin. What do you see as the value of a database like Mispronouncer and now Pronounce Wisconsin, which takes Jackie's work and puts it on a map?
Oh, it's huge. One of the things that we really want to understand these days is how, not just how language varies over space, how it varies from one place to another, but also how it changes over time. And these resources are great for seeing that and for being able to track it. I use it regularly in teaching. I'm teaching a course called Language in Wisconsin this semester, and I've got a bunch of students who are actually interested in place names, and they're already looking at it and looking at how local pronunciations are different from what's recorded there, how things have changed over time.
Yeah, my grandpa is from Port Huron, Michigan, which he called till the end of his days Port Yorn, Michigan.
Yeah.
Jackie, did you run into a lot of contested pronunciations? I've heard arguments over Racine versus Racine, for example.
Yeah, I think that one is the biggest one. So Racine could be Racine, Racine, or Racine. In fact, I talked to some people who lived there for a long time, and they kind of assured me. They said, well, as long as you're somewhere in the middle, don't say Racine or Racine. Just kind of say it fast enough, and maybe no one will notice. But another big one that comes to mind is like Two Rivers. I mean, it's spelled like you can imagine, T-W-O-2, and then Rivers. But locals might say Trivers.
Sure. And Joe, how common is that? We may have an accepted pronunciation, but language happens in the real world.
It happens in the real world. In fact, the first time I ever used the place name Two Rivers was around somebody from Sturgeon Bay, and she stopped me in absolute horror and said, never say that. Say Trivers. Well, it changes and it varies a whole lot. So the small town in northern Wisconsin, Oulu, most people say now, was traditionally, it's a Finnish town named after a town in Finland, city in Finland, and it was traditionally pronounced Oulu. And there's still people in town who say it that way, but now it's mostly Oulu. And you have, examples like New Berlin for what was once upon a time Berlin or Berlin. Prairie du Chien has the same kind of story as Two Rivers. There's an old traditional pronunciation. So I think that really adds a lot of richness that we're seeing these variations and this change over time.
Jackie, do you have you had people argue with the pronunciations you put online?
Yes and no. It was always a polite argument or maybe a suggestion or something like that. Once or twice. I mean, nothing major, but it definitely is the subject for conversation. And I see it even now on, you know, Facebook or other social media. You've got people talking about it and pointing to the website or making little videos when a sports team comes out of town. It comes from out of town. You know, you've seen those before.
Now, with something like Racine, I don't care how they say it, as long as they keep making the kringle for me. But Jackie,
yes.
you have one that does bug you right at the top of your website. We are from the state of Wisconsin, not the state of Wisconsin.
Yeah, I think that was always a big thing for me, long before I even thought of the idea for the website. People would say I would pick up on things. I'm a great observer, and I would listen to people talk. I would always watch the three major TV network news broadcasters. You remember Tom Brokaw, Peter Jennings. So I would hear people talk, but then randomly I'd hear people say Wisconsin, and it would just kind of get my goat.
We are talking about Wisconsin's unique place names and how to say them. Jackie Johnson is with us, the creator behind mispronouncer.com, and Joe Salmons, a linguist at UW-Madison and co-editor of a book called Wisconsin Talk. Well, Joe, I think one of the challenges of trying to say all these Wisconsin place names right is there's a lot of diversity in the languages that they came from and then the languages they were translated or interpreted to. Can you share some of that history behind our wide variety of place names?
It's just remarkably local. It changes almost every place you go. Almost every place name has its own different history. You see a lot of names that were a lot of the native names, indigenous place names in the state were first, of course, in French and then came into English. So you've got these really complicated patterns of transmission. You've got places that were named, given names in immigrant languages or indigenous languages, and those have changed over time. And because we have so many different languages and cultures that have made up the state historically, we do have that just more richness than almost any place in the country, I think, in terms of how many different sources we have.
So, Joe, hypothetically, we could have a pronunciation that's how, what, Polish immigrants pronounce the French translation of an Ojibwe word, right? I mean, it can be that complicated.
It can be that complicated, and it even gets more complicated. The famous case of the name of the state is the subject of a bunch of scholarly literature. There are articles about how Wisconsin came to be called Wisconsin and what it means. It looks like it was probably originally written with an M at the beginning, and somebody just misinterpreted it, wrote it as a W, and so it changed in that way. And there's a lot of literature about it came from one of the Algonquian languages. A lot of people say Ojibwe, some people say Miami, Illinois. And it's just hard to tell because of that complicated transmission. It was first attested in French, then it came into English, and of course, it with lots of through lots of different other communities with different kinds of speech.
Interesting. Now, I promised I'd share some of mine. I mentioned this on the air the other day. Oregon, not the state of Oregon, but the Wisconsin town of Oregon, is one that puts me into this feedback loop of second-guessing myself. Jackie, that one, I mean, it's pretty easy to denote how to pronounce that. Is that one you've encountered people stumbling over?
Yes, and I kind of smirked when you said that because not just people, quote-unquote, but me, myself, I have to think about it. I have to pause before
Same.
I say that one, too.
All right. And this is a pretty common thing, Joe, where you mentioned we've got Berlin, not Berlin. You heard me pause there. This seems like pretty often that you'd have that expected accent and it swaps for some reason in that local name.
Yeah. What happens is over time, as the languages being used in a community change, people's pronunciation habits change. And there was, of course, a long time in that part of the state. German was very widely spoken, not just by people who came or whose families came from Germany, but a lot of Anglo-Americans and others learned German. And so they knew German pronunciations and they used German pronunciations. But as that faded away, people have shifted slowly to using more and more English pronunciations. And where the history is deeper, where the language is further away, like in the case of French in Wisconsin, you get pronunciations that are really very far from French. I mean, Lake Butamore is just, if you say that to a French person, they're typically amused.
Well, there's one that derives from French. That's another Rob stumbling block. Lac de Flambeau. I think I just nailed it. But in the moment, live on the air, I start thinking Lac de Flambeau. No, it's Lac de Flambeau. Jackie, that's one of those French ones. I'm, again, notoriously bad at anything French. Is this a common stumbling block, those French origin names?
Yes, and Fond du Lac.
Yeah, people want to do Fond du Lac.
Yes.
All right, I got one, Joe, a mystery for me. The case of the missing A, I'm talking about Shawano, Wisconsin. You look at it, it looks like a three-syllable word, Shawano. This stymied me for a long time. Joe, what happened? Where'd that syllable go?
It's just perfectly normal pattern of English. It's an unstressed syllable, and so you just lose it. It's a Menominee name. It's a Menominee word. It's the word that means, in modern Menominee, Shawano means south or southern. The town is actually named after a Menominee leader. There are two people with the same name, so we don't know for sure which one. But it just, it got adapted into English that way, with that unstressed syllable being being lost. And it, yeah, it's definitely one of the confusing ones for newcomers.
It's perfectly normal. Nothing to see here.
Now, Jackie, in your work on Mispronouncer, I'm guessing you've talked to a lot of people around the state, trying to confirm pronunciations, things like that. Do people take a lot of pride, and do people have a lot of strong opinions about how to say their local place names?
Yes, they do. And when I first created the site, that's what I did, is I talked to a lot of people, whether I called them on the phone or visited locals. And, you know, obviously a lot of them I knew because I grew up in the state in various cities, and I worked in radio for 30 plus years. So, you know, you just listen to people, you pay attention. But, and a lot of people were proud to tell me about their city, how it's pronounced, and how other people don't know enough to pronounce it accurately. I mean, you get all these stories, and it's nice. It's nice to hear. But as you stated earlier, even to this day, once in a while, someone will contact me and say, wait a minute, I have a disagreement with that one there.
And Joe, I know at various points in U.S. history, there have been efforts to record people talking, right, in their languages of origin and their unique accents. Do we have a good, I guess, geology? Can we go back through time and see how the accent has changed?
Yes, indeed. We have the great Frederick Cassidy, who started the Dictionary of American Regional English, did recordings around Wisconsin in 1950 and 51. And a lot of those recordings were of older people. People did oral history recordings starting in the 1940s in various languages and in English. And so we've got lots of stuff. We've got old recordings of Cornish people from Mineral Point and on and on. So we've got lots of that, and we can go back. The recordings are good enough that we can actually do phonetic analysis of them and see how things have changed. And of course, like Jackie says, people talk a lot about place names, about where they're from, where they've moved to, and so forth. So that's a pretty prominent part of the record.
Jackie, Mispronouncer just had its 20th birthday. Now we've got that new map from the state cartographer's office featuring your voice. What's it like now, 20 years in, to have your voice be representing the place names of Wisconsin?
Well, it's really awesome, and it's an honor. And I think the folks at the cartographer's office, they've done a very good job, and they're always tweaking it and revising it. And I'm really proud to see that. But to be quite honest, every once in a while when I go back and I listen to one of the names, I thought, oh, that's nice. Nice job. And then I listen to another one. Oh, my gosh, that's terrible. I really need to re-record that. I always want to re-record everything I've ever done.
We'll leave it there. Jackie, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Joe, thanks for being with us.
I really enjoyed it.
That was Jackie Johnson, former radio broadcaster and the creator of Mispronouncer.com, and Joe Sammons, a linguist at UW-Madison. We've been talking about Wisconsin's place names and how language and pronunciation evolves over time as Mispronouncer marks its 20th anniversary this year.
As a new year kicks off, we're looking ahead to covering cool stuff happening all over the state.
And you can help. Is there something going on in your community that you want to share with the rest of the state? Maybe it's a festival, it's a nonprofit doing really neat stuff, or a unique business. Maybe it's an awesome natural area. You name it, we want to hear about it.
You can share your suggestions with us by email at wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Or you can call or text us. The number is 888-642-0232.
Share your local story ideas, and we can dig into them here on Wisconsin Today in 2026.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today.
While you're there, you can explore our archives of great conversations and share your favorite Wisconsin Today interviews, too. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.